Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on May 7th, 2019. This is the 15th week of our Tuesday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on two suttas that describe the five hindrances and the proper application of refined mindfulness for recognizing and abandoning these common obstacles to awakening. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's the concluding class for our Tuesday night 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. It's on the hindrances. The hindrances are something that could be taught right at the beginning of any Dhamma study, at any point in between. I think it's appropriate at the end of a structured study because as the Buddha teaches these five common hindrances, that's just what they are. They're obstacles to developing the Dhamma. They're something to apply the very refined mindfulness that the Buddha teaches. In other words, to hold in mind these hindrances so as not to let them become an obstacle to our Dhamma study. And they are common hindrances. The Buddha didn't just teach these occasionally because he really didn't have much to talk about that day. The Buddha never wasted a word or a teaching. He taught hindrances in quite a few suttas. There's going to be two tonight and a third one, a new one on Saturday too, in relation to hindrances, because they are something that we need to be mindful of. They're not something that happens to other practitioners who aren't quite as committed as we are. They're common practices. If you've ever struggled with your Dhamma practice, whether it's because of fear or doubt or commitment, it's precisely because one or all of these hindrances are in play. So as a Dhamma practitioner, as Dhamma practitioners who want to fully integrate and develop the Dhamma, these are parts of, they're parts of our thinking rooted in fabrications that need to be noticed and directly abandoned. Again, they're not something to play around with. let me read into the sutta and I'll comment some more on it. This is from the introduction. The Buddha taught that in order to develop jhana, a well-concentrated mind, that can then support the refined mindfulness necessary to integrate and develop the Eightfold Path as the framework for Dhamma practice, mindfulness of these five specific hindrances is imperative in order to recognize and abandon them. We have to know what we're working with. And rather than a mind that's rooted in ignorance creates these very subtle and powerful strategies to ignore its own ignorance, and ignoring any or all of these hindrances is precisely that type of strategy. It's a strategic decision to use something that's occurring within me to say I can't go any further with the Dhamma. And doubt is a good one. And simply, I doubt this is true. I doubt that a guy actually taught this that's useful. And we find a few people to say, well, you should doubt that because it's not that, it's this. And there we're off to the races and we're building on our doubt rather than using the framework of the Eightfold Path to resolve our doubt or our fear or our anxiety about it. David brought up such an important point on, was it last Tuesday, about restraint? I can't remember, was it? And the difficulty at times when we really get down to understanding what is wise restraint as opposed to just restraint that is rooted in a reaction to what's occurring. And a good way of understanding that is if restraint is driven by one of these hindrances, it's restraint that is rooted in ignorance of the way things are. Restraint that recognizes and diminishes these hindrances is wise restraint. So there's, you know, restraint is just a word. There's restraint rooted in ignorance and there's restraint rooted in wisdom. And therein lies a difference. And that, again, directly applies to this. Another word for hindrances is obstacles. These five hindrances are self-imposed obstacles commonly employed in a subtle and often unnoticed, meaning strategically ignored, internal strategy to continue to ignore ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Rather than avoid responsibility through these hindrances, through pop psychology influenced modern Buddhist practices that overanalyze these hindrances to the point of distraction, The Buddha taught the why and how of applying the Dhamma in specific ways. In this way, the Buddha taught an effective Dhamma that avoids embracing these hindrances, that only encourages continued eye-making. Is that last rather long paragraph clear and understandable?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it really is these very subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, strategies that we employ that are to ignore our own ignorance that are rooted in these hindrances. And again, that's why the Buddha taught them, so that we can directly address them and abandon them. The Avarana Sutta is a simple and direct teaching on what these five hindrances are. The Nibbana Sutta, the second sutta tonight, is a bit more elaborate and teaches the proper application of right mindfulness to recognize and abandon these hindrances. Nibbana, the title of the second sutta, means extinguished. The entire Buddha's Dhamma is developed to recognize and abandon the fires of passion that arise, meaning extinguish them, that arise from ignorance of Four Noble Truths and ongoing conceit. The Avarana Sutta. On one occasion, the Buddha was near Savatthi at Jita's Grove at Anathapindika's monastery. He addressed those gathered to hear the Dhamma. Friends, there are these five hindrances that overwhelm mindfulness and weaken wise discernment. So right, you know, immediately he gets to the point that if we don't want our mindfulness overwhelmed by them or to weaken our discernment, our ability to choose wisely, we must recognize and abandon these things. Sensual desire is a hindrance that overwhelms mindfulness and weakens wise discernment. On Saturday's talk, and I encourage you to listen to it when you can after I post it if you're not here, that sutta, the Buddha teaches how to feed and starve hindrances and how to feed and starve the seven factors for awakening. Another word for feeding is sustenance, how to provide sustenance for these hindrances or to deny sustenance for these hindrances, how to provide sustenance for the seven factors or awakening or deny it. But these are similar in that the Buddha's teaching that we need to recognize and abandon them. Sensual desire is a hindrance that overwhelms mindfulness and weakens wise discernment. Ill will is a hindrance that overwhelms mindfulness and weakens wise discernment. Laziness and drowsiness are hindrances that overwhelm mindfulness and weaken wise discernment. Restlessness and anxiety are hindrances that overwhelms mindfulness and weakens wise discernment. Why do I have that in there twice? And uncertainty or doubt is a hindrance that overwhelms mindfulness and weakens wise discernment. Those are the five hindrances. And if you look at those clearly, those five hindrances incorporate every other possible hindrance we could come up with, no matter what label we put on it. The Buddha continues, I will provide a simile. Suppose a swift mountain river flowing unimpeded, carrying everything with it. A person builds many side channels so that the current in the middle would be dispersed and dissipated. The slowed river could carry along everything, could not carry along everything, I'm sorry. The slowed river could not carry everything or go far. In the same way, when a person clings to these hindrances, they are weak and ineffective in developing the Eightfold Path. We've dispersed the energy that we have for developing the Dhamma. The Buddha continues, it is impossible for these people to understand what is for their benefit or for the benefit of others. Why? Because we're in a very real way, our mindfulness is elsewhere. We're mindful of what our hindrances are driving us towards considering rather than developing the Eightfold Path and simply addressing them and abandoning. So I use the example that is often used today of cultivating doubt and embracing doubt as your Zen Dhamma practice, Dharma practice. And of course, it just flies into the face of this. But think of all the time you might spend on embracing your doubt and encouraging your doubt and cultivating your doubt. That's all time you just wasted that you could have been simply meditating and integrating the Eightfold Path. I'm just using that as a good example of how something that seems wholesome and useful and skillful is really just another distraction from developing the Buddha's Dhamma. And there's an endless list of examples of how that can manifest. Okay, let me just read that last line again. It is impossible for these people to understand what is for their benefit or for the benefit of others. It is impossible for these people to develop awakening and a true noble distinction in knowledge and vision. Now, suppose a swift mountain river flowing unimpeded, carrying everything with it. A person comes along and closes all the side channels. I mean, we start becoming very focused in our Dhamma practice. The middle of the river would be unimpeded and would not be dispersed and dissipated. The swift river would carry along everything, meaning the whole Dhamma would have its own momentum. And it would go far. In the same way, when the wise Dhamma practitioner abandons these five hindrances, it then becomes possible for them to develop strong discernment and are effective in their development of the Dhamma. The wise Dhamma practitioner understands what is for their benefit and for the benefit of others. They understand how to develop awakening and a truly noble distinction in knowledge and vision. That's the end of the Avarana Sutta. Pretty simple and direct, but are there any questions about that? Okay. The Nirvana Sutta, or the Nibbana is the Pali word. And again, Nirvana, Nibbana means, it's usually used to describe awakening, and it has many different connotations. The Buddha used it to connotate that Nibbana or Nirvana means extinguished, meaning we have resolved the problem of being inflamed by the passions of our own eye-making, our own conceit. And through the Eightfold Path, we have extinguished those fires. So the Nirvana or the Nibbana Sutta. And notice the title given to this. I mean, that's pretty important, calling something the Awakening Sutta. And it directly addresses the hindrances. On one occasion, the Buddha was near Savatthi, Ajita's Grove, Anatha Pindika's monastery. He addressed those gathered to hear his Dhamma. Friends, be mindful of these five hindrances. I'm going to go through this. Let me say it the way I wrote it. Sensual desire is a hindrance. Ill will, because I'm just repeating it. Ill will is a hindrance. Laziness and drowsiness is a hindrance. Restlessness and anxiety are hindrances. Uncertainty or doubt is a hindrance. These are the five hindrances. In order to abandon these five hindrances, the wise Dhamma practitioner should develop the four foundations of mindfulness. Simple and direct, isn't it? And the four foundations of mindfulness initially are used to establish a right meditation or a right concentration practice. So the Buddha is saying that if you want to address these hindrances, you first have to have a measure of concentration. Why? So we won't be distracted by them. The wise Dhamma practitioner remains focused on the arising and passing away of the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside greed and distress in reference to worldly events. The wise Dhamma practitioner remains focused on the arising and passing away of feelings in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. The wise Dhamma practitioner remains focused on the arising and passing away of thoughts in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside greed and distress in reference to the world. The wise Dhamma practitioner remains focused on the arising and passing away of the present quality of mind in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside greed and distress in reference to the world. What's the importance of what I just read there in the context of what the Buddha is teaching and in overcoming the hindrances in our meditation practice?
Just go back to the Four Noble Truths.
What do we do when we find during a meditation session that a hindrance has arisen and it's distracting us? Come back to the four foundations of mindfulness. A hindrance that is experienced as a feeling or a reaction, what do? Come back to the sensation or breath. It might be a long train of thought that makes us realize, wait a minute, I'm caught up in thinking about doubt and uncertainty. What does the Buddha teach you? He doesn't teach us to embrace it. He doesn't teach us to take it and analyze it in some structured way. In meditation, in reference to the four foundations of mindfulness, when we find that we're caught up in a hindrance, that a hindrance is leading to further distraction, we come back to the sensation of breathing. Period. And in that way, think about this in a way of applying or sustenance, what we're going to talk about Saturday, giving something energy. the more that I think about something, the more energy I'm giving it, aren't I? I mean, the simple way of saying it is what we focus on, what we hold on internally expands, at least even in our consciousness. Unfortunately, we can't think about, you know, a pot of gold and it's going to expand, although people teach that. But what we hold in mind is going to determine, we learn this through a lot of these classes, that what we hold in mind is going to frame what's occurring in this moment. And what if I, and if what I'm holding in mind is this thought that because I'm full of doubt, as a self-referential thought, meaning I am doubtful, now I'm compelled to figure it out. Why am I like this? The Buddha's saying, don't do that. This is more distraction. Recognize that you're full of doubt in this moment and come back to the sensation of breathing. And every time we do that, as opposed to embracing the doubt or nurturing the doubt or cultivating the doubt, we're diminishing the doubt. And really, what we're diminishing, even though it might seem so real at first, is like foam on the ocean. There's nothing really there because it's fabricated. We're addressing something that is an actual hindrance, an obstacle to awaken. There's no reason to develop any kind of being enamored with it in any way, even though it's ours, David.
Aren't the hindrances just all craving?
You could characterize it or.
I mean, ill will. You're just wanting it to be something different than what it is.
Exactly, and all of these are, aren't they? Doubt is wanting, even within Dhamma practice, doubt might come up because we at least understand on a subtle level where it's taking us, and we don't want to go there, so we doubt that this is
overlaid. You can overlay it onto the dependent origination and see how you can get into that cycle.
Wow, yes you could. In each and every one of them
is, and then by applying it and taking it to the Dhamma, you're abandoning the ignorance.
Yes, that's right. And so you can look at each and every one of these hindrances in relation to dependent origination and see that they are a factor of every one of those links, aren't they? Excuse me, beginning
with
fabrication.
I'm sorry, I don't see what you're talking about.
Well, look at it in the simplest, I think it's the seventh,
yeah.
Between from craving comes clinging and maintaining. From becoming distracted by my hindrances, I'm obscuring the craving underneath it, and I'm using that embrace of this hindrance to further my clinging. And even in that simple and direct way, it's a continuation of something that's rooted in ignorance. Do you see that? Because that's really important, what you brought up.
Go ahead.
So, wow, that's really a wonderful way of putting it.
And then
the hindrances are the most powerful strategy that we all employ to ignore ignorance. Yeah.
The seven factors, and keep it in mind as it arises that it's simply passing and it's not real. And it's that ignorance that makes you cling to that, and you're going to become in the next moment ignorant.
And that ignorance compels us to cling to it. Why? Because we've self-identified with it. It's mine. Rather than, no matter how much doubt, I could have been living with this unbelievable doubt for 63 years. It consumes me. It's still not me, is it? No matter how much I want to identify with something that is fabricated, I can't ultimately claim in reality that it's me, no matter how much I think it is.
And it could be as simple as the beeping phone. That's ill will. I'm wishing it was something different.
Yeah.
But because of the practice, it just passes.
It just passes. It's just what's occurring in this moment. I don't have to react to it at all. And that's most of life, by the way, folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we really start learning to not take things personal, we find out that there's nothing personal. The Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. We are then just experiencing life as intended, meaning as these six properties. That's all we are. But a self-referential ego self doesn't want to hear something like that's all we are. But in describing ourselves in reality, we realize that we're all that we ever need ourselves to be. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
We can meet any challenge ever when we understand what the true challenge is. The true challenge isn't having the strongest body or the best looks or the most money or the biggest house or the fastest car or the most power or the right political party or any of that. The best thing to have is knowledge, isn't it? And that's what the Buddha teaches, true knowledge, true useful and skillful knowledge. But if we allow ourselves to be continually sidetracked, the side channels the Buddha's using in the simile, create those in our lives, these constant distractions, these constant side channels, the Dhamma can't flow within us, can it? But if I close up those channels through mindfulness, through refined mindfulness and concentration, then I enter into the flow of the Dhamma, hence the simile or the metaphor of the stream enterer. It takes that kind of focus. So, and as David's talking about this, you're also acknowledging that in a skillful way, the hindrances are part of Dhamma practice, aren't they? If we're recognizing the manifestation of hindrances and not letting them distract us, but applying the Dhamma as the Buddha teaches, we are in the midst of Dhamma practice. It's exactly what we should be doing. The reason why I'm saying that is we can use the fact that we have hindrances to address as another hindrance. Oh, I'm just too far gone, I'm too whatever, to actually develop the Dhamma. We're no different than anybody else. We're no different than the Buddha in that regard. He was able to do it, we can too. I'm going to conclude this. The wise Dhamma practitioner should develop these four foundations of mindfulness, these four frames of reference, in order to abandon these five hindrances. Yes. That's the end of tonight's talk. I thought I might have put something else in there, but then I realized I took it out. So, again, I encourage you to listen to Saturday's talk. If you can't be here, Lorna says you won't be here, because it addresses that feeding and starving the hindrances.
Last
and
Saturday seven, or this coming?
This coming Saturday. So I'll be concluding the Saturday Dhamma study with a slightly different talk on the hindrances. So, again, as the Buddha teaches these different themes and different topics, he's teaching them for us to be mindful of them in a way that furthers our development of the Dhamma. Again, I'm trying not to overemphasize the hindrances while emphasizing the importance of recognizing and abandoning them, because there's no real substance to these hindrances except what we give them. And so when we find that we're caught up in a hindrance, as wise Dhamma practitioners, what do? We come back to the sensation of breathing. And that's all we do. If we try to figure it out or analyze it, we're just getting stuck in it. So that's tonight's talk. Any questions directly on these hindrances? Okay, let me ask Jane to join us first. Jane, would you like to join us?
Hi, John.
How are you?
Good. Great class. I'm so glad I could hear you tonight.
Yeah, sorry about last week.
Okay. But no, I just... You know, go back to the sensation of breathing. I mean, that's the bottom line for me.
Yeah, and see things in reality as they occur. So that's wonderful. You're going to join Matt and I on a trip up next week?
Betcha.
Great, 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 great. All right, I'm glad you joined us tonight. Lorna, good to see you.
Thank you. The hindrances sometimes are a bit difficult to speak about because they're just with us all, to some extent they're with us all the time, but so subtly that you don't always see them. And perhaps we don't give them enough attention as we maybe should, because they're so subtle in our thinking that we kind of, for instance, this sutra has come on the heels of karma, which is a huge sutra in the Dharma, with a lot of heavyweight stuff you can get your head around it, and to think about it and focus on it and understand it and think about it some more and understand it some more, and that's what that is. But the hindrances are not kind of like that. They're a lot more subtle. even slippy in your mind. You can say that like slippy, you know, you can sort of like be thinking one thing and it was, the hindrances will slip into your thinking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's very tricky really to follow in your mind and in your thinking. I would think it would be easy to sort of think of about one hindrance, such as the first one, passion or whatever it is, and you think, you know, that's the one that really bothers me the most, but it probably isn't. It's just that the others are more subtle at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm sure all of us at some time have trouble with each one of the five hindrances.
Mm.
But it's easy just to see one and focus on it and not see the others at some other times, you know. So it's they're very difficult to bottom out in your thinking and really see them for what they are sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. If I could just, and I'm not picking apart words, but if I could pick apart one word, you said trouble. The hindrances aren't, it's best to see hindrances as a distraction, which is trouble, rather than something like that, because that's exactly what they are. And they are subtle at times, but they're also very plain. In other words, they're subtle because it's like looking at ourselves in the mirror and trying to see what's inside of us. You know, they're just so close to us. They're what we identify with these often. In fact, people often characterize themselves in certain ways in relation to a certain hindrance, that this is how I am. You've mentioned something in the past about occasionally becoming overwhelmed with something.
Mm-hmm.
That's an aspect of doubt, isn't it? Or uncertainty, becoming overwhelmed. You're not sure of where you're going with this, or even if you can get there. That's part of that umbrella of doubt or uncertainty. And uncertainty is an aspect of impermanence, isn't it? If things weren't impermanent, there'd be no such thing as uncertainty. The things would just be. They would be stuck in something. So it's very subtle, but it's also very plain. And the solution is still the same thing. When we find ourselves caught up in it, as David was talking about last week, we practice restraint at the point of contact and remind ourselves that, wait a minute, this doubt, this fear, this anxiety, this ill will, this hatred towards somebody or a political, whatever it might be, this need for sensual stimulation in this moment, it's not me, it's not mine, that's not who I am, that's a hindrance. And I am a wise Dhamma practitioner, and I don't want hindrances in my life anymore. So let me take another breath and move into the next moment without me in it. Thank you.
Okay.
Ram, good to see you.
Yeah, I was looking back at all the doubt that I had when I first came here. And that took me a long time to stop actually identifying it.
I'm sorry, by my expression, I interrupt you. I didn't mean to.
Yeah, it's... And looking back at it, the identification with it is interesting to see now, because it's gone.
So help us out, because you're in teacher training.
Mm.
How? Don't worry, I'm putting somebody on the spot. Huh?
Well, that's... Part of it was still being engaged in meditation there. At that time, I didn't have my daily meditation practice, but I had my weekly or bi-weekly practice here, and it wore it down.
That was enough to beginning to begin to develop enough concentration.
Develop enough concentration. And also see the practical benefits of practice. That's another thing that kind of made my doubt dissipate.
Yeah, what a good point, because you see the benefit in it. That's how we that's how we do it, because we see the benefit in it.
Right. And it made it easy to abandon it. Well, easy. It's, you know, doubt is a lifelong practice in my life.
Yeah.
But I started to see that that was no longer, it was no longer to my benefit to practice this doubt. Because it was a practice that I had.
Yeah.
Doubt everything. But, you know, part of that was also that I started to study more.
Yep.
So, you know, engage in the Dharma more than doubt it. And those two kind of, you know, the balance shifted.
Wow. Well, you bring up such a good point. And again, excuse me for interrupting, but I have to here. There's a difference, we were talking about restraint too, there's a difference between wise restraint and restraint rooted in ignorance. There's a difference between a disappointing experience with something leading to question whether it's a skillful practice to be involved in.
Mm.
That kind of doubt is what led me to look at what the Buddha actually taught.
Right.
And so again, to understand how to address, it's not enough to say, oh, I'm doubtful and just make a blanket statement that you should never have that. The solution to doubt rooted in ignorance is to see things through the wisdom of the Eightfold Path. And then you can choose wisely. It's based on something, not just based on foolish beliefs. And that's a significant difference. I keep referring to the Eightfold Path as the framework and guidance. That's really what I mean. It frames the way we're supposed to be looking at things. The Buddha here taught the same thing. If you're struggling with the hindrances, the first thing to do is to look at your meditation practice. Are you well concentrated? And keep coming back to that. Thank you. Helen, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Today I had the experience of driving up and back on Route 12 more than once, and they were doing some work on the road. And so I'm flowing along one way, and I'm stopped. They put up the stop sign, and I have to wait. And then I keep going afterwards, and then when I come back, this time it says slow. So this time I can keep going. So it's sort of like what we were just talking about. You know, the obstacles are there, the obstacles are removed. But I was also just now thinking about the whole concept of doubt. And my compulsion is always to be truthful and honest. And when I pose an honest question to someone, my instinct is to accept that what they're saying back to me is also honest. Mm. And that isn't always the case. So I have to work on a way of skillfully dealing with that, either accepting that I have accepted something to be true when it's not, or what? Not have skillfully used doubt to reach the truth. So that's kind of something I'm going to have to work on.
Thank you for bringing that up. Again, the Buddha recognizes that difficulty.
Mm.
And he gave us an Eightfold Path in which to see things and frame things so we know.
Yeah, so with the Eightfold Path, I know what to do if I have been given a non-truth. And how to sort it out and how I can move on. But I'm going to have to figure out how to call it at that moment in a skillful way to be able to then get the truth from the person I'm speaking to. So
yeah,
there's got to be a way that you can then turn them around so that they feel more inclined to be truthful.
You got to be careful with that, Helen, because there's an aspect of that that could be seen as manipulative of the other person. And again, I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but that's a caution. But the Eightfold Path teaches us to be in speech, in thought, word, and deed, to be honest, and to allow other people to be who they are. And if we find that they're dishonest, we understand that it's rooted in ignorance. It's not, and that's where it protects us from possibly being less accepting of someone because we think that they're being dishonest with us, and so now I generate ill will towards them. Yeah. Recognizing that is that's what's arising as I take a breath and I incorporate my understanding of the difference between approval and acceptance.
Right.
I accept this person because they're standing in front of me, and I also accept the fact that in the moment, no human, unless someone is pathological, and most people aren't. True pathology is very rare in the world, even though people fall back on it. Unless someone is truly pathological, they know they're lying and they're not feeling too good about it. You know.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a cultural thing too that there are certain allowances for things not being quite true.
Yeah.
It's sort of a an unintentionally
We have a word for it. White lies.
Like, you know, come see me anytime. Well, maybe someone means that, and maybe they really want that phone call first. You know, I'm more of the, like, you know, hey, I love people to just drop in. But, or, call me when you need help, you know, whatever. And I don't know. There's that kind of thing that's, I guess, falls under the white lie category. You know, but then there are people who, I hired a woman on a Thursday. On Monday, she didn't show up. I called her, did you have trouble finding it? No answer. Called her again, are you in a ditch? Do you need help? No answer. I ran into her at the Home Depot.
Ooh.
And I said, I'm glad to see you're not in a ditch. And she said, no, something came up. Well, you know, you could have called me. Nope, would have been a really nice thing to do, to just call me and let me know. It's just kind of a nice thing to do. And I left it at that. But there's that kind of behavior is becoming more and, you know, it's almost more acceptable. It's not such a, you know, like...
Yeah.
You mean more acceptable to you?
No,
in the way
not
you live?
To me. I just think it's more prevalent. Maybe that's a better word. I think the iPhone also creates this culture of, someone calls you, you're texting back and forth, and then you don't want to talk to them anymore. You just cut them off, you know, and you don't say goodbye.
Oh, yeah.
You know, or, I don't know, there's just that ability to ignore people that is becoming more a part of our culture.
Think about what you just said, Helen. Say it again, please, if you can.
Where?
The ability to ignore.
Yes.
It's becoming part of the fabric of our society, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And what's the problem of ignorance?
Mm-hmm.
It leads to all the suffering in the world. It leads
to
fabrications. Leads to misunderstandings
mm-hmm.
between people. So. You know, and I'm not a doomsayer either. It's just what's developing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that we are developing very powerful structural strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And it works very well, doesn't it, unfortunately?
Mm-hmm.
So you bring up such good points. And bringing it back to these simple teachings, as Dhamma practitioners, what I need to do is to develop the Dhamma and be mindful to not let these hindrances stop me from fully developing the Dhamma.
Right.
Because the issues that you raise are resolved through wisdom and not through continuing ignorance.
And I can use the Eightfold Path so that I can continue and I can be okay. And if I see this girl again, I've said my piece and I don't have to say anything more. I can ask her where something is and be perfectly fine with it.
Yeah.
If you've recognized the ill will that you may have had previously and then abandoned at that point.
Yeah, so again, it's that side of the sign? Do you have the stop sign or do you have the slow sign, you know, as you go through situations? You know, sometimes sometimes you can stop and, you know, pull yourself together and get on the path, and sometimes you got to slowly work your way back in. But, you know, as long as those are just the two sides of the sign, you know, you're okay.
That's right. And you have the framework to make that decision now. That's the difference.
You know, if you step off the path, you know where it is.
So. Yeah. For years and years and years ago, it used to drive me crazy when people would, there was a time when I had about 16 guys working for me. So every day there was one or two that just didn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to take it personally, which means eventually they took it personally too. Until I slowly got to the point where I realized that's just what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what they're doing. It's not meant. Years and years ago, I got to tell a quick story. I made friends with this guy named, I still remember his name, Robert Wolf. He lived in Volcano, in the town of Volcano on the Big Island. Just one of those remarkable people that, you know, we're lucky to meet a few of them in our lifetime. He was one of them. And I still don't remember how I came across Robert Wolf, but we became fast friends, and he used to invite me over to his, he had this great house right in the, on the top of a volcano. Talk about a great place to live in the rainforest. And we had these great conversations, but he was a lot of things. He was a structural engineer, a chemical engineer, and also an amateur anthropologist. That was what he really loved to do. And he told me a story about one time he was somewhere in Africa, I think he said the Congo, but wandering around, he came across a tribe of people that had never seen human beings ever. This is going back about... Either human beings or other human beings. And so they were just wonderful people. They took him in like he was one of them. They gave him his own little hut to sit in. They fed him, made him feel comfortable. And he noticed this one guy who in the middle of the day would get up, and it was obvious that he was sneaking around, and he'd go into somebody else's hut and he'd come out with a handful of stuff and bring it into his hut. And he did this a few times. And Robert's watching this and go on for a few days. And he finally sat down with the elder and he said, you know, I've been watching so-and-so. Every day he does this. He takes a bunch of stuff out of somebody's tent and brings it into his own. I never saw him bring it back. What are you doing about it? What do you do to stop that? And he says, oh, you mean so-and-so? We don't do anything. He's a thief. The point was that's what a thief does. And in their community, what else would he do? And because they didn't take anything personal, and they didn't own those little baubles, it was more important to leave him alone and let him do what he wants to do. He's a thief. They saw it clearly. They had nothing, as using the Buddhist terminology, there was nothing in them to provoke ill will towards him because of the way they saw things. Remarkable, isn't it? I miss Robert Wolf. Thank you, Helen. It was a really great comment. Mary, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. You know, what comes to mind is that, you know, it's in the early stages of learning this, you're realizing the things you cling to and you crave to are just things that we as human beings cling and crave to. You make it more specific to yourself as your awareness increases. So there's this constant looking in the mirror, and then you think you have some progress. And then there are these hindrances, right, that are still here. Sort of just to remind you that there's more work to be done. And, you know, when you find yourself, you know, I think some of this just runs so deeply that it can be hard to recognize. Oh yes, these aren't things to justify. These aren't behaviors to justify. These aren't reactions or whatever that make any sense. These are hindrances. And because we all live in the phenomenal world, and we all live in our different work environments too, which often tends to be the test of this. That sometimes it can feel like some of these hindrances are necessary to survive in the phenomenal world. or that they're necessary to survive in corporate America or whatever, right? Because we've been trained that way, but they're not. They're still hindrances to being on the path. Like, so you can never justify ill will. You can never, or the opposite of, what hindrance were we talking about?
Doubt.
You know, conceit, right? Is that sort of opposites, right? And how they manifest, you know, they can't be justified.
Yeah.
And that's really taking a look in the mirror to whether you're in the moment or in hindsight. I know we talk about not analyzing, but sometimes I find that the awareness comes from not analyzing within your meditation, but looking back on, well, that didn't go well, you know, and then realizing, oh yes, hindrance 3, 4, and 5 present, you know, and how you felt that was right or righteous or whatever, and it was either doubt or conceit that was blinding you to realizing that those hindrances were in full bloom in those situations. So again, it's recognizing them. How quickly can you recognize them? Can you recognize them in the moment? Can you bent back on the path? You know, that's I guess I sort of just said the obvious, right? That's what this work is all about.
Yep.
And even when you think you've made some progress or had insights or whatever, there's still stuff there. That you're still clinging to, right? If clinging and craving were your, I suppose they're all of our issues, right? If those were your issues that manifested in other ways in your life, and then you found this practice and you've been shedding things, you're still, the hindrances remind you that that there's still work to be done. There's an opportunity there. So anyway, I'm just very grateful for that lesson and the right view that can bring to a situation, to allow it to not be personal and to be able to let it go and move on. So I appreciate this.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for your insightful words. Occasionally hostile world, we tend to justify our own hostility, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
That it's necessary, and sometimes it does. It seems like it is necessary. But isn't it interesting that some of the great people in our lives are ones that understood? I'm thinking about Gandhi or Nelson Mandela, and those that exampled that. That type of reaction is never helpful. But also using that as a recognition that there's still a little more work to go to do is important too. But also to understand at a very, very subtle level, any one of these hindrances is simply a consequence of having a human life. And if they're not overwhelming us or distracting us, that's all that they are remnants of conditioned thinking.
And
that's a good way to, it's important to look at, to notice that. If they're not driving your life anymore, you've resolved the problem of hindrances.
Right. There was something else that I listened of yours or read to about karma and fabrications. You know, the role of karma and fabrications on, like that, you were just explaining karma, right?
Yep.
So when you're in the middle of hindrances and you're reacting to something, that is your karma.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And I thought that really illuminated, it must have been something in close proximity to this class, like it must have been a couple of classes ago when I was catching up. And I thought, I hadn't looked at it quite that way. I don't know if I even delineated the insight that I saw in that moment, but it was one of your talks on karma. And that in that moment, that's what you're putting all over that reaction and that that hindrance is in there, and that's all that is mucking up your karma.
Yeah, if the karma is the field, consciousness the seed, craving the moisture, the
mm-hmm.
Bhava Sutta. So in the moment, my karmic field, if I'm stuck in a hindrance, that is my karma unfolding
right.
in this moment. I'm so full of ill will towards so-and-so.
Yeah, all your
well, look at that. You don't have to, and there's a difference between analysis and honestly looking at something. Analysis is always looking for the root cause and the blame of something and taking it to its an almost endless examination rather than recognizing the root cause of hindrances. If I analyze it clearly, it's a fabricated view of myself in relation to the world. That's where it comes from. That's why this hindrance is bearing fruit in my field of karma in this moment. You know, so karma is the overarching field where everything is growing, manifesting in my life, and in this moment, one of those plants that's sticking up is a hindrance. And it's arising in this moment because my thinking is still rooted in fabricated view,
yes.
and I'm still craving for something to be different than it is.
Right.
And that's why I feel that way. Thank
good
you.
Good stuff.
Yeah. David, good to see you. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. I'm all set.
Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you. How are you?
Good, thank you. I think I'll do noble silence.
Glad you're here. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I don't have much to say at all. I enjoyed what everyone said. The benefit of the Dhamma is that whenever you do think you've made progress, you realize it's like the, when I was doing work for a nonprofit, you would solve a problem and get through something and realize this, that only gave you permission to work another, 48 hours to get the next problem solved.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how I look at it, You can take a minute to be grateful that you've made an accomplishment in understanding, there's always more work to be done. So.
Yeah, there is. Well, up until a point. Thank
up
you.
Up until you awaken.
Yep. Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Russ, good to see you. How are you?
It's a hard axe to follow, but I think that the distractions and hindrances to me are just preventing you from living the life that you should live.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
And the further you take them, the less you're living the life you should live.
What a beautiful way of saying it. Yeah, that's exactly it. We're limiting our own potential towards
right.
peace and happiness. And that really is it. And so why? I mean, really, ask
right.
yourself, why would any sane person do that? Well, the truth of the matter is that as far as understanding the way things really are, Four Noble Truths, we are. We're not seeing those clearly. We have wrong view. The Dhamma takes us from wrong view to right view. And all of these all of these different themes, as we were talking, are all basically the same thing and just different ways of approaching them. Dukkha is the hindrances, aren't they?
Right.
I mean, you can,
right, yeah.
Karma is the hindrances. Anatta
right.
is dukkha. Dukkha is
right.
is anatta. Impermanence is impermanence is anatta. Impermanence is dukkha. Dukkha is impermanence. Karma, all of that.
Right.
It's all different ways of looking at the same issue with the underlying impetus being ignorance. Again, everything comes back to that. Great class. There's something else. Can't think of it. We'll finish as we always do. Our retreat is a week from Thursday. Please come. There's still some room. We got about, 15 or 16 folks are coming.
Wow, that's great job.
Yeah, I think 4 or 5 new folks. It's always nice to meet new people. And then we followed online. But. So we'll finish with metta as we always do. If I can find it. I I should know it by heart, but I don't. The Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Jane. See you next week.
Okay, have a good week, John.
Thanks, you too. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.